The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager, and today we're going to be talking about Ant-Man, the famous tiny little superhero who was on the big screen over the summer, and about the science behind it, miniaturization, ants, all different kinds of crazy, wacky science things that are actually, some are true and some are not. Before we get into that, though, I want to remind the audience that we do more than just podcast. In fact, if you follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, you're going to see all the other things that we're putting out there. We've got videos like How Stuff Works Now videos about weird science and technology. We're also doing blog posts over on stufftoblowyourmind.com every day. So make sure that you subscribe to whichever one of those, you know, channels is your particular favorite social media thing and follow us there, because we're, you know, curating stuff all the time.
And if you listen to us on iTunes, do us a favor. Head on over to iTunes and give us a nice review. Help boost that algorithm in our favor. It's a great way to support our show.
And one last thing. We have started working on the other social media platform called Periscope. We've been doing it for about, I guess, 2 months now. And we try every Friday at noon Eastern Standard Time to be available for about 20 or 30 minutes, hang out with our audience, talk to you about what's going on with the show, what we're recording, what we're researching, and what we have coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we won't be on, we're currently recording this right before Christmas. So it's going to be a little bit off schedule, but once we get past the new year, I think we'll get back onto that Friday schedule.
All right, well, let's launch into it. We're talking about Ant-Man, we're talking about ants, we're talking about the possible science of miniaturization. Ant-Man, of course, is the latest Marvel Cinematic Universe movie to come out. Came out here in 2015. As of this recording, it has just hit the digital streaming market.
Oh,
and
is that right?
Okay. I believe it's either out on DVD and Blu-ray now, or it will be very soon.
Okay.
I believe you saw it in the theater.
I did. I saw it in the theater. I am, as many of our listeners know, a huge comic book fan and try to support comic book movies for the most part. I was a little bit on the fence about this one, to be honest, but I did go see it in the theater.
Cool.
And I liked it okay. It wasn't like my favorite or anything, but the science was particularly interesting.
Yeah, the science was. I just saw it last week, and I really enjoyed it. I definitely came into it not you know, wasn't certain what to expect because on one hand, I don't have any real attachment to Ant-Man.
Yeah.
And I, even though I love miniaturization science fiction, as we'll discuss, I was kind of like, well, isn't it enough that he's little? Why does he have to talk to ants too?
Oh, yeah.
And then I also had been following some of the production history with Edgar Wright being a part of it and then not being a part of it.
That was part of my hesitant.
Yeah.
The reason why I was hesitant to see it was I'm a big Edgar Wright fan. And I had followed, you know, we don't need to go into all that here, but I had kind of followed the troubled production of this movie and was really looking forward to his take on the character. But I think that there's some glimmers of his voice in that movie still.
I think so, yeah.
And Joe Cornish, too, the guy who did Attack the Block, also helped work on the first
draft. That's right. Yeah, I thought the end result was heck of a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. And after I saw it, I said, hey, let's look at this. Let's do an episode.
You knew that I was a big nerd. So here's the thing. Like, for this episode, I'm going to try to restrain my comic nerddom. I am going to probably cover the segment on just sort of how comic book Ant-Man compares to movie Ant-Man. Mm-hmm. And I'll probably interject here or there, but Robert's going to keep me on track and we're going to try to stick to the science of this because there's some really fascinating stuff that, you know, I honestly, like, approaching this didn't think was going to turn out to be true.
Yeah. It's kind of funny how much great science there is in the film. So just to start off, let's talk a little bit about miniaturization science fiction itself, because this provides sort of the soil from which Ant-Man initially emerges. And then the latest incarnation, the film, also, comes out of this history.
Yeah, there's a fascination, I think, that probably popped up in the late 50s and early 60s, which is when Ant-Man the comic was created, with the idea of shrinking and or growing things, right? We were fascinated with giant ants and bugs and stuff being monsters in horror movies.
And I think a lot of this comes out of increased awareness of what's going on at the smaller levels of nature and also our ability to share that with the general population. People are able to see these close-up photos and learning about our continuing exploration of these tiny realms.
Yep.
So one of the big ones that we have to mention is, of course, Richard Matheson's novel, The Shrinking Man, and the subsequent 1957 movie, The Incredible Shrinking Man. And I've read, I don't know how this matches up with the timeline, I've read that these were supposedly a big influence on Hank Pym, the Ant-Man character.
The Ant-Man character?
Yeah, right. About his first adventure in which he falls into an anthill.
Yeah, that's the first comic that they did at Marvel with him. And I don't even know if he was necessarily a superhero at that point. I think it was just kind of a, you know, scientist, mad science gone awry story. But yeah, man, Richard Matheson, like when you go back and look at that guy's resume, he influenced so much pop culture.
Oh yeah, he did. And of course, we have to mention the 1966 film Fantastic Voyage, in which a tiny submarine that contains a miniaturized Raquel Welch and a miniaturized Donald Pleasance and some other people that of varying importance.
Yeah.
And they are, you know, sent into the bloodstream, going in there to address an illness at a very small scale.
Yeah, there is a fascination, like, with this shrinking and growing thing, right? Like, the ones that I remember are more often the growing ones, like Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. That's one, right? That was one of those, like, big, movies of the time.
Amazing Colossal Man. That was another
and
giant.
Them?
Film.
Them was the ant.
That was the ant
movie.
One.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Fantastic Voyage itself kind of spins off into its own little franchise. Isaac Asimov did the novelization in 1966, and we'll discuss some of his science that he injects into the franchise in a bit. He also did Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain, in 87. I read the former novel, but I remember trying to read the second one. I was like in junior high at the time, and I think I just kind of timed out on some of the science again at the time. I should give it another read. Kevin J. Anderson did Fantastic Voyage Microcosm much later, in which the crew explores the body of a dead alien.
Wow.
That sounds interesting. And I was surprised to hear that in 68, there was a Fantastic Voyage animated series. I don't think I've ever seen a clip of this.
Haven't either. Yeah. That's, in fact, like my knowledge of the whole Fantastic Voyage, you know, franchise is rather limited. This sounds like a treasure trove of stuff to go back to.
Yeah. And then, of course, Fantastic Voyage itself directly influenced, the fabulous 1987 film Interspace.
This is one I remember from growing up. I was 10 when this came out, and, they hadn't, I want to say it was like Universal Studios or something like that when I was a kid, had an Innerspace ride.
Uh-huh.
And it was like one of those things where you went into a room with like shaky seats and you basically watched a movie where like Martin Short or somebody walked you through as you went through the human body, you know. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a great film I remember to watch as a kid because mm-hmm. you had all this Martin Short, manic stuff.
Dennis Quaid was the other
Yeah, guy. Dennis Quaid was miniaturized yeah. in this cool little submarine in Martin Short.
Yeah.
And then in the climax that I must have watched dozens of times as a kid, you had the bad guys miniaturized as well in his own little robot suit, and they do battle in the stomach.
It's kind of
Martin
a prequel
Short.
To Ant-Man.
In a way, yeah.
They didn't really go in anybody's body in Ant-Man.
It's true.
For the most part, it's because he's ant-sized and not, like, they're, like, microscopic.
They're much smaller.
Yeah.
But very similar, especially when you get into the battling
of
miniaturized foes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Fantastic Voyage and Innerspace went on to influence, there's a Futurama episode, Parasites Lost. do you remember this one? This is where Fry gets intestinal worms from eating a tuna fish sandwich that he buys from a condom machine at a galactic truck stop.
Always a bad idea.
That's a great miniaturization episode.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful Rick and Morty episode titled Anatomy Park.
I can only imagine the mind of Dan Harmon at work on something like that. Sounds like a Jurassic Park, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids mashup.
Yeah, but pretty much. It's kind of a Fantastic Voyage meets Jurassic Park. So you have all these deadly viruses that are kept in kind of a Jurassic Park inside the body of, I think it's an alcoholic, homeless Santa Claus.
Okay.
And then you get yourself miniaturized and then you go and visit and you can meet all these terrible, pathogens.
Yeah, this sounds like Dan Harmon with an unlimited budget. So, and then I just mentioned Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which is, you know, what were there, three of those movies or something like that? I can't remember, but.
They shrunk the kid and then they blew up the baby.
Something like that, yeah.
And then I don't remember, I think there was a third, but I never saw it.
They were definitely, I want to say that those came out sometime in my preteen years or something like that. So mm-hmm. I remember seeing them, but I don't remember a lot about them. It was that sort of era when like CGI was just really starting to become convincing.
Yeah.
So the idea of Rick Moranis getting shrunken down into his front yard and having to travel around with all the, I believe ants. Again, ants are like the go-to for this miniaturization thing.
Yeah. I mean, because as we'll discuss in the second half of this episode, they are so fascinating and their world is just so alien and intricate that we can't help but imagine ourselves immersed in it.
And then, you know, a lot of this spawned into and also out of comic books. There is as much of a fascination with miniaturization in comics as there is in film and television from that time. So you've got Ant-Man. DC has their version of Ant-Man, which is the Atom.
Okay.
And then Ant-Man has his wife, the Wasp. Well, sometimes wife, sometimes not wife. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And, there's all kinds of other series. In fact, there was even, I think, in the 80s, there was a series called Micronauts that was it was sort of like Star Wars meets Ant-Man, right? Like the mm-hmm. idea was like they lived in this tiny microverse that was so small. It was completely it was sort of like the quantum realm, from Ant-Man.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, tell me about Ant-Man. I'm coming at it as a guy who basically knows what I saw in the film and, you know, skimming a few, comic wiki pages about him.
Okay.
Give me the full story.
So Ant-Man's created in 1962 at Marvel Comics by the usual suspects, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, also with some help from Larry Lieber, who is Stan Lee's brother. The character has usually been the version that Michael Douglas portrays in the movie, right? The older Hank Pym character.
Okay.
Except for he's not older in the original comics. But the gist is he's a super scientist who fights crime. The way he does it is he has these Pym particles that he's invented that enable him to shunt his mass or gain mass from an alternate dimension. And he either shrinks or he gets big. And he used to like swallow capsules, I think, when they first came out. Then he breathed in particle filled gas. I think that's why the Ant-Man helmet sort of has like a gas mask look to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, if I remember the, the canon correctly. There's something about how his body absorbed the Pym particles, so he was basically just producing them on his own. And he could, at will, shrink or grow, and he could also, like, shrink or grow other objects nearby him or other people.
Okay, so is it kind of like the whole Spider-Man deal where at times Spider-Man is shooting webs because he's made fantastic little devices, and other times it becomes more a part of who he is physically?
No. I think it's like, cause those are two, like, this is super nerdy, but that the comic book version is the one with the web shooters. The movie version is the one where it shoots out organically.
Oh, okay. So he never shoots it out organically in the comics.
They retconned it, later on in like the 2000s.
Oh, okay.
For a series called Ultimate Spider-Man. But yes. So, in this case, I think it was like sort of the same character in the same universe, but he just, you know, over time they were like, capsules, that's kind of lame. Let's do gas. He doesn't need the gas. He can just change, you know? And so the deal was he was Ant-Man. He joins the Avengers. He usually teams up with his girlfriend, sometimes wife, Janet Van Dyne, who is the Wasp. And in the movie, they sort of hint at that and they show flashbacks to their crime fighting career together. The thing about Ant-Man, so spoilers for Ant-Man comics that are like, I guess, 40 years old at this point. The thing about Ant-Man that isn't really touched upon in the movies at all is that he has tons of different identities. So Ant-Man isn't just Hank Pym's identity. He also becomes Giant Man, where he just grows and smashes things. And then I guess he thought Giant Man wasn't a cool enough name, so he changes it to Goliath. And then he changes his name to Yellow Jacket, and he starts shrinking again. And then there's even a point, I think it was, this was in the 2000s, where the Wasp died or something. Mm-hmm. And to honor her memory, he became the Wasp. So he was like the male version of the Wasp.
All right. So he recognized that you got to keep mixing it up. You got to keep reinventing yourself.
So much so that, like, I believe it is part of the character's history that he had multiple personality disorder, because, like, he was having a difficult time tracking all of his secret identities. And something to do with the particle ingestion was messing with his mind. So, like, when he's the Yellow Jacket character, he's almost like a different person, and sort of a villain. And sometimes he gets brainwashed by villains. Other times he's replaced by shape-shifting aliens. So this character has this, like, really bizarre history of sometimes just being completely aloof to what's going on in the rest of the storylines around him, basically because he's not himself. To the point that there is a classic storyline in Ant-Man that I'm sure the film producers tried to stay away from as much as possible, in which Ant-Man becomes very aggressive in his persona as Yellow Jacket and has a mental breakdown. And when the Wasp tries to intervene, because they're married at this point, he hits her and is expelled from the Avengers. They end up getting a divorce. And then I think, like, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years later in the comics, they resume their romance. But so he's sort of like the Ant-Man I grew up with reading in the 80s was always this, like, disheveled guy who had, like, been broken because, like, he had this mental breakdown and then, like, was sort of reviled by all the other superheroes because he hit his wife. And also he is in the comics the guy who invents Ultron, the big bad robot from the Avengers movie.
Oh, yeah.
So everybody's like, great, you hit your wife and you invent this robot that accidentally tries to kill us all the time.
Okay, so luckily in the Marvel films we've gotten to move that off and blame that on Tony Stark.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They chose to give that to Robert Downey Jr. He was already charming enough.
All right, well, let's get into the movie a bit. Now, before we get into the miniaturization science and the quantum physics and then ultimately what we see some of the ants doing in the picture.
Yeah.
You want to touch on some of the just straight up caper science that we see employed.
Yeah, well, when I was watching it, I was sort of stunned by the scene. So again, if you haven't seen the movie, we're going to spoil the hell out of it this episode. But Scott Lang, who is the not Ant-Man at this point, the premise of the movie is that Scott Lang breaks into Hank Pym's house to steal the suit. The sort of heisty stuff that he does to get in past his defenses were science-y in a way. And at the time I was watching it and I was like, this is completely false. Like, there's no way that you could get past a fingerprint scanner with super glue the way that he does. And in fact, Joe and I are working on something right now about forensic science, and super glue fuming is a thing that is done to gather fingerprint evidence. And so much so that it's one of the few ways that you can pull a fingerprint off of a dead body. So there is some science to that, but it's not necessarily, I don't know that you could take the super glue itself, reform it, and then turn it into something that a fingerprint scanner would understand.
Yeah.
You know,
much less do it on the fly like that.
It's like, oh, yeah.
What is this fingerprint scanner? Let's get some super glue.
Yeah. And I don't even want to get into, doesn't he like freeze the door somehow?
Yeah.
Break
he like
through.
Bust the safe by filling it with water and then freezing the water.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe there's some science to that one too. I didn't look too deep into that, but I wanted to mention that they at least tried. There's some stuff going on there. The super glue thing is, slightly accurate. But the reason for this is that they had, an actual scientist on set who was sort of their, I guess, reference point and, advisor. And his name is Dr. Spiros Michalakis. He's from Caltech, California, and he consulted mainly about quantum physics and the miniaturization stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe he also was like, by the way, you can break into this lock with super glue.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
All right, so we're going to touch on some of McCallicus's thoughts and on the science of Ant-Man. We're also going to reference The Physics of Superheroes by James Kakalios.
Yeah, a lot of Greek guys looking into the science of superheroes here. So I do want to add here before we dive into this that, so obviously it would have been ideal if we had done this right when the movie came out in theaters, but I actually like that we're not, because so much was paid attention to the science in articles or in other kind of, you know, content that was created around the internet when that movie came out, that we're able to sort of gather it all together, compare notes, and do like the full shebang now.
Yeah.
Where like Wired had some pieces and Nerdist had some pieces, but they didn't have like all of it together. And this, I feel like we're able to bring it all together now a couple months later.
Yeah. And plus, if you're like me and you only get out to see a movie in the theater once or twice a year, then, you know, this is maybe a more ideal time. So, let's start off by talking about miniaturization, which, again, we've seen in so many different science fiction films and TV shows and comics, but how would it possibly work? So here's the thing, just to get this out of the way. Miniaturization, as we comprehend it, is physically impossible based on our understanding of physics.
There's so many reasons why it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Not even just the miniaturization, but we'll talk later as well. It's like, even if you could come up with some way to miniaturize a body, there's so many things that would go wrong with that body once it's miniaturized.
Yeah. It's like going from, you know, Duplos to normal Legos or vice versa.
Yeah.
So as Kakalios points out in his book, At a very basic level, matter is made out of atoms, and the size of an atom is a fundamental length scale of nature, and it's not open to continuous adjustment.
Right.
And furthermore, Isaac Asimov, who of course had to crunch the science way back when he did his novelization of Fantastic Voyage, which is interesting because, as I recall, the story there was, they said, hey Isaac, we need you to write a novelization of this hot new film. And he's like, I don't want to do it. And they finally agreed to let him to get him to do it, provided he got to tweak the science and and make it work a little bit.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. So in his novelization, he points out that to make something smaller, it requires either one, making the atom smaller, two, removing a large fraction of the atoms, or three, pushing the atoms closer together.
Right. And there's, I believe Kakalios and others have sort of debunked why those things wouldn't work either.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I should also point out, we mentioned that sequel that Asimov did, Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain, and in that, he provided his own sci-fi model for miniaturization, which involved the creation of a, quote, local distortion field that changes the value of Planck's constant. And that's a physical constant that is the quantum of action, central in quantum mechanics, and it's a fundamental constant of the universe. But if you could adjust Planck's constant and therefore make it, I guess, Planck's adjustable, you could shrink things as you please. But it's all sci-fi magic as to how you might do it. And I think that's ultimately a part of any of these models is there. You can sort of say, all right, point A, and we can get sort of say point C, and we can get our result. But there's a missing point of magic in there that involved. And that's what makes it science fiction.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to, like, the connecting thread between the things, even as much as you do. You know, I admire that he did the research to sort of kind of come up with various ways, but they don't necessarily connect. But so Kakalios, in his book, argues that if PIM particles were somehow able to change the mass of electrons, that those particles would then be in closer orbits. And this is called the Bohr radius. We're going to end up talking about this and Planck's constant quite a bit. And so those particles would be closer in orbit to the respective atoms and molecules that they surround. And because electrons and the interactions between them are ultimately what prevent these objects from ever really touching each other, having all the electrons in an object suddenly gain mass would theoretically shrink the whole object. But again, I'm not quite sure that all adds up. So, and like we said, atoms are always the same size, right? In fact, they're a third of a nanometer. That's kind of how we quantify them. This is, as Planck's constant implies, a constant of quantum mechanics. So if you change the size of an atom, you would have to come up with a mechanism that just changes the value of all constants in science, right? It would just completely throw off physical properties of everything, not just like shrink things. So instead, Kakalios recommends this changing the Bohr radius method, which is related to the average size of an atom. I don't know. I don't think they actually add up. But there is another person who did some really great science articles over at Wired.com. I believe his name is Rhett Allain. He always does these fun articles looking at the science of superheroes whenever one of these big budget superhero movies comes out. He did two articles on Ant-Man, and so he proposed two options. One was Ant-Man could keep his same mass, but in this scenario, his density would increase, okay?
Okay.
So he shrinks, but he's super dense. At half an inch tall, he would be 2.8 million times more dense than a regular human. So he would obviously just sink right through everything. He would sink through a tabletop. He would sink through the earth, you know?
So he wouldn't be able to ride an ant around.
No. But he would, like, kill every ant he sits on. Yeah.
But I remember thinking, like, when they just miniaturized him in the film and suddenly he's showing all these superpowers. I was thinking, well, maybe there's a certain amount of density involved.
Yeah.
Like essentially he's this really heavy bullet that can just launch himself.
Yeah. Like that
things.
He's, or like that he's moving the density around in his body some way, right? Like maybe he's moving that 2.8 million times of density into his fist. And that's why when he punches people at super tiny size, I don't know. It doesn't quite work out, but that was one of Elaine's best, guesses. So there's that, or he could keep his same density and have a lower mass, but where does the mass go? And that's essentially the argument of the Stan Lee science behind this, which is, well, it just goes into an alternate dimension.
So, like there's an exhaust pipe of just pure energy.
Yeah. I want to know, I want to like see what this alternate
dimension white hole
looks like
somewhere.
That's
just it's the
like
Hank Pym
all
white
of
hole.
Hank Pym's mass, or what kind of mass is he pulling in when he grows larger? But yeah, so the idea here is that, you know, it would potentially also convert to energy. Like if you're shunting that kind of mass around, I think Elaine even says at one point that like that, if you do the math on it, the amount of energy that would be created if he was shrinking down to the size he is could like power a city or something like that. So the best he comes up with is this shifting mass thing, putting it into other dimensions. And the way he looks at it is like, well, he does like an illustration of, if you move two dimensions into three dimensions, here's how it would work. And then he sort of hypothesizes maybe what's going on with Ant-Man is he's shifting three-dimensional mass into a fourth dimension somehow that we're not quite aware of. This would allow him to have the same mass, the same strength and everything, but he wouldn't actually be small, right? It would just be like an illusion because we're seeing like a fourth-dimensional object in three dimensions or something like that.
Yeah, we have three spatial dimensions and a fourth dimension of time.
Yeah.
But in this case, it would be a fourth spatial dimension.
Exactly.
Which makes me, you know, try and imagine it. It's kind of like this big dude and then he becomes small and he pushes his excess mass out into a gigantic tumor that extends into another spatial dimension.
This is what I think the people who are currently working on Ant-Man comics should be exploring is like, what does that gross fourth dimension look like where he's just pushing mass and pulling mass? There's got to be something creepy to tell.
Yeah, there. I'm just imagining like origami and an Aphex Twin video coming together.
Yeah, it'd work perfectly. I think that's what the Edgar Wright version of the movie would have been like. So, okay. So this leads us to the big question. Yeah, miniaturization is totally impossible. But what about this whole Ant-Man strength thing, right? So the premise is
right, because that's a big part of it. It's not only is he small. It's one thing to be small and like spy on people and maybe move their pins around. But ultimately, he's also able to fight dudes that are giants to him.
Yeah, in the movies, he's like, he can jump with this amount of strength that he would have if he was normal size. So he's this ant that's leaping up and jumping around guns and stuff like that and punching people out. And this goes back to the comics in Tales to Astonish number 38. Pym says that he retains all of his normal size and strength when he shrinks. And Kakalios asks in his book, how does Ant-Man punch his way out of a paper bag? And he uses an example from one of the old comics in which Ant-Man gets trapped in a vacuum bag. I think like he gets vacuumed up and he's in the bag and he just punches his way right through because he's like, well, I have the strength of a normal sized guy and a normal sized guy can punch through this bag. So no whoop. There's interesting science behind this that it may be plausible. Now, remember the miniaturization. We don't have an answer for that, but our actual strength comes from our skeleton and our muscles, and they act like a series of interconnected levers, right? So think of strength as lift, and our arms are the levers that lift things and throw them, right? Well, if you use the principles of seesaw and torque, as Kakalios does, he argues Ant-Man could punch his way out of a bag. Basically, it goes like this. The ratio of movement in the human arm is 1 to 7, regardless of what your size is, right? It's all about the cross-sectional area of muscles in our arms. So it's not the length that matters, it's sort of their proportions, okay? So if Ant-Man, this is Kakalios's math, if Ant-Man is 0.01 times his normal height, the force of his muscles provide a reduced factor of, ready for it, 0.01 squared, which equals 0.0001. And at normal size, if he could punch with a force of 200 pounds, divide that by his fist cross-sectional size of 5 square inches, okay? The pressure his fist applies is 40 pounds per square inch. So he's making a rough guess that like a normal size person, you know, could probably make about 40 pounds per square inch punch. Okay. At tiny size, he delivers less force, right? In fact, it would be, in comparison to the 200 pounds, 0.02 pounds. But his fist is also smaller. So the force per unit area of his tiny punch also comes out to 40 pounds per square inch when you do the math, which is 0.02 pounds divided by the size of 0.0005 square inches for his fist size. So Kakalios did all this out, and he thinks he, regardless of the size, he can punch with the pressure of 40 pounds per square inch and therefore punch his way out of a paper bag. But my question is this. What happens when he grows? I know in the Ant-Man movie, like, he hasn't gotten to that point yet. I'm sure that'll be in the sequel where he gets big, right? But, mm-hmm. I think there was a scene where, an ant accidentally, ingested the stuff and got big,
yeah,
right?
It gets the size of a dog and it has no problem moving around.
Yeah, yeah. So, based on this cross-sectional area math, mm-hmm. does that then mean if, he's giant man, that he's still also punching with 40 pounds per square inch? Because it's based on the cross section of his fist size and the force that his arm is applying.
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole set of constraints that come into play in when you start thinking about the giant size. For instance, Kakalios points out that you could compare giant man to a redwood tree.
Okay.
So the taller the tree, the wider the trunk. And in order to provide support for the large mass above it, the tree needs a very broad base. And he says, quote,
right.
Giant man could, in principle, grow as tall as a redwood tree, but he would have to be just as mobile. So he'd just immediately fall over.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I remember there's a point where they sort of update the comics. And when he does the giant man thing, that's something he talks about. He has a really hard time balancing. It's more about the anatomy.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Than it is about, the size.
Yeah. An example that I've run across, multiple times when dealing with large, fantastic creatures, particularly when you're talking about Godzilla and King Kong
sure.
and stuff, is think of a cow as a sphere. Okay. A spherical cow. And as a sphere gets bigger, its volume increases more rapidly than its surface area. Double the radius of a sphere, the surface area increases 4 times, and the volume increases 8 times. So you double something's size, and you keep its proportions the same. Well, that means that the weight doesn't double or even quadruple. It increases by a factor of 8.
Mm.
So a creature's morphography, especially human morphography, wouldn't be able to match that. You need stockier limbs.
Right.
Giant man might need to walk around on all fours like a dinosaur.
That would be great.
And then you'd have to also factor in things like blood flow and other issues.
Yeah.
Think of the giraffe. Since the giraffe's brain is so far away from its heart, it boasts an extremely high blood pressure, about twice that found in humans. And plus the giraffe heart beats up to 170 times per minute, double that of humans. And the plumbing is also positioned so that there's a special net of arteries and veins that divert blood flow when it lowers its head to drink to keep this increased pressure to the head from making its head explode.
Yeah. The PIM particles may address the fictional science of shunting mass to another dimension, but they certainly don't address all those anatomical needs, both in the large form of giant man or Goliath or whatever mm-hmm. he wants to call himself this week, or when he gets tiny as Ant-Man, right?
It's kind of like thinking from an economic point of view. Imagine a McDonald's restaurant in a small town, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking about the economics of it, if you were to say, hey, let's make this a bigger operation, let's put one on every street corner. Let's do 16 McDonald's restaurants in this one small town. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's not isolated.
Right.
It's not
existing in a bubble. It's tied in to the economic infrastructure of the surrounding area. And that's what we see time and time again with miniaturization or Giant Man, is that whatever the size of the being, its atomic structure, its molecular structure, its morphography, every aspect of its existence is tied into the fabric.
It's going to have to exist in the ecosystem around it that isn't shrinking or growing.
Right.
And that is the hard part.
Yeah, that involves the building blocks, that involves the function, everything.
Yeah, and this is, why, we always hear this, I don't know what the exact figure is, but ants are 50 times stronger than human beings are for their proportional size or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is basically why, because of that whole cross-sectional anatomy type thing, right?
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Okay, so Ant-Man gets his strength from the fact that an organism's volume is dependent on the cube of its height, right? But if you extrapolate the math all the way outwards, you get these ants that can lift objects that are many times their own mass, right? So that's where that comes from. It's that the anatomy of the ant is giving them the strength, not necessarily the size.
Yeah, and I imagine they also took some inspiration from the jumping power of the common flea, which has the most tremendous jumping potential for its size of any creature on the planet.
Yeah, that's definitely like the bits where he's like bouncing around and jumping off bullets and stuff. All right, so there's a scene in the movie where, and this is like, I think, pretty spoilerish for the movie, he shrinks down so small that he enters into. Do they call it the quantum realm in the
movie?
They
do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so basically the fictional premise here is that like there's something with the suit where like if you don't regulate it the right way or something, you shrink down and you're lost forever in the quantum realm. And this is what happened to the original Wasp.
Like
right?
If you try and go too small in order to, you know, go through a particularly difficult a material, then you run the risk of just getting smaller and smaller, entering the quantum realm and just losing yourself in a place where the rules of our physical world don't necessarily hold
sway. So this is sort of like the movie logic and comic logic, I guess, of like why he doesn't get smaller than half an inch tall, right?
Yeah, because he gets way out of his league, the smaller he gets. And of course, this is based in large part on a very real place that we as scientists actually call the quantum realm. And this is where events play out at distances of nanometers. Many laws in classical physics, appear to break down. So in the quantum realm, for instance, scientists can predict very little with 100% accuracy. According to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you can't even measure the position of an object without disturbing its momentum in an unpredictable way. Classical physics also fail to account for this phenomenon as it serves as a prime example of what we call quantum weirdness.
I like that.
Yeah. There's also the so-called EPR paradox, named for Albert Einstein, Bohr's Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen. And this applies an even stranger example of quantum weirdness, in which two subatomic particles thousands of light years apart can instantaneously respond to each other's motions. And this is, of course, quantum entanglement that takes place at the particle level. And in 2009, scientists were actually able to produce the effect with linked superconductors.
Jeez. Okay.
So it's a place where, where things get weird. Things are we're still trying to understand how everything works. It's also a perfect place for magic and the unexplained to emerge in a comic book.
Yeah, and definitely, like I think. A lot of people described Ant-Man as like the weirdest superhero you've ever seen. And I think the quantum realm stuff is probably why, because like when he goes into the quantum realm, it's basically like a psychedelic acid trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought they did a good job of presenting it that way. Cause I mean, how do you visually present this quantum realm? And,
yeah. Well, the human senses at that size wouldn't be able to comprehend what's going on.
It's interesting too. You ask if they actually call it the quantum realm in the movie, and apparently, we can thank Michalikas for that, because they were going to call it the Microverse.
So, okay, that's from the comics. That's why I was surprised, because I was like, oh, it's the Microverse. He's going to go to the Microverse where the Micronauts live.
Right. But the thing is, like, apparently Microverse is tied up with some legal issues.
Yeah.
So they asked Michalikas, they said, hey, what's a better term? And he rattled off a list of possible terms, and they said, ooh, quantum realm, that's the one.
And, ooh, the real thing.
Yeah, it's both the real thing, and also it sounds more fantastic than any of the other options.
Yeah, I don't remember what the deal is with the legal issues, but Micronauts is owned by some toy company, like it might be Kenner or somebody like that, and therefore I think things that are related to that can't be used by Marvel in cinema.
So what are some other issues that that pop up?
All right, so let's pretend for a second that we can miniaturize. Let's agree with Stan Lee science or shunting mass off to an alternate tumor dimension. But there's lots of issues with our human anatomy when we get to that size. So just think about communicating if you're Ant-Man size, right? If you shrink to the size of an ant, your vocal cords will shrink as well, which will raise your voice from 200 hertz to about 3,400 hertz. So you'd have this really high-pitched, squeaky voice. So even if he had like the little headset or whatever that allows him to communicate with normal-sized people, they would just hear this really high-pitched, like he just, I guess, sucked in helium or something.
Yeah, you'd have to have an adapter that then is translating it into normal speech.
Yeah. And this is from Kakalios, by the way, in his book. And he also did some interviews around the time that the movie came out. So he also wouldn't be able, Ant-Man wouldn't be able to project his voice because he'd have so much less air in his diagram. Again, like, he's shrinking. The size of air molecules are not shrinking. So he's not going to be able to fit them in his lungs, right? Also, the vibrating cilia in his ears would also shrink, which would go from him being able to hear 20 hertz to 340 hertz. He wouldn't be able to hear normal human speech, which, again, is at 200 hertz. Mm-hmm. So it would just be like this tone that he's not able to distinguish. And Finally, his vision would be terrible, because the size of his eye opening is not as ours are, hundreds of times greater than the wavelength of light, right? So when he shrinks down, now it would only be like 10 times as great as the wavelength of light. This would basically make everything fuzzy and blurred because light waves would be scattering off of his iris and diffracting differently than they normally do. This is why insects have eyes that are so drastically different than our eyes.
Yeah. And even so, the ant from whom he takes his namesake have generally terrible vision.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it would work perfectly that Ant-Man couldn't see Jack.
And we talked about density, briefly, but again, if he can ride on top of an ant, then his mass has got to also decrease in some way. Or if his density remains constant, because keep in mind, density equals mass divided by volume, he's going to sink right through the ant. It's so many dead ants. Breathing. So I talked about this briefly, right? So, okay. He's going to have trouble breathing. And they sort of hint at that, right? Like, that's in the movie, they're like, well, he has to wear the suit. Like, you can't just shrink in the
suit. Like, he has to have a miniaturized air supply as well because he needs miniaturized air molecules to breathe.
Yeah. They don't really address how they're miniaturizing the air, but let's assume that that's what they're doing. But essentially, the science would go like this. If you were suddenly shrunk down, the air would be like as if you were at the top of the tallest mountain. The amount of air would stay the same, but the volume it occupies would drastically increase relative to you and your new tiny size. So if you're the size of atoms, there's no way you could inhale the billions of oxygen atoms you would need to keep your human-sized metabolism running smoothly.
Again, it ties into the economics of this creature, and it has to exist within the local economy.
And Michalakis also brought up the idea of Ant-Man would have some problems with cooling down. So because he wouldn't have the same amount of surface area that he normally has to dissipate the heat that his body generates, even moderate exertion would generate an incredible amount of heat without anywhere to go, unless maybe the heat is also going to that magical fourth dimensional tumor thing.
Yeah, or his suit is operating as a cooling still suit.
Yeah.
Which also doesn't work, as Joe and I explored in the Dune episodes.
It's all weird. Even down to the point where, like, apparently, I think this was another Rhett Allain article, that he would run really weird. So the same way we were talking about, like, if you're giant size, you would need to have, like, kind of stumpy legs to balance, right? If he gets shrunk down in proportion to the gravitational field, he would be running in this very bizarre way, and it would be, like, kind of like these small hops is what it would basically look like. And that's not even getting into the materials science, right? So maybe he can shrink himself, but how does he shrinking his suit or his clothes or all the other things around him? In the comics, they explain it away with something called, that Stanley was just like, unstable molecules. That's it. And unstable molecules are actually a real thing, but these are the molecules that are falling apart or exploding for one reason or another. So that's not really much of an answer, but in comics, that's like, this is how the Human Torch can, like, set himself on fire and his clothes don't burn away.
Okay.
Or how Mr.
Hulk's pants, right?
Yeah, Hulk's pants, or Mr. Fantastic can stretch really far and his clothes don't rip. Presumably Ant-Man is also wearing something made of unstable molecules. The closest we've got to this in real life is their shape memory materials. And they basically have an original configuration and then they get deformed. And they can undergo phase transitions based on, like, temperature changes, pressure, or applied electrical fields. So, like, a superhero example of this, think of Batman in those Christopher Nolan movies. He applies an electrical field to his cape, and it makes it hard so he can kind of glide around. And then the electrical field goes away, and it goes back to just being a cape.
It's kind of hilarious that a certain amount of thought and science, or at least science fiction, went into trying to figure out how to make these superheroes wear clothes. But when it comes to the female characters especially, there's a tremendous amount of effort in trying to make them wear as little as possible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So they might as well have just said, hey, sorry, science says that our superheroes can't wear clothes. They have to be naked.
If you really want to go down the internet rabbit hole, look up how many costumes the Wasp has worn over the years. I believe they explained it away at one point by saying, like, oh, she's a fashion designer. So she's constantly changing her costume, but, like, there's like hundreds of costumes, and they go from, kind of conservative and moderate to, it gets pretty skimpy around the 90s. Okay, so let's talk about these ants. So the premise, if Ant-Man's power set is shrinking and controlling ants, right? And how do they explain it? That the helmet somehow emits frequencies or pheromones or something like that that allow him to control ants' movements. Basically, like he's like playing a video game, right? The way that they show it in the movie is like Hank Pym even wears like kind of like it looks like a hearing aid, but it's actually like his little controller, right?
Yeah, it's like a cybernetic helmet, I think it's sometimes explained. But this gets kind of iffy as to how he's actually controlling them, because when it comes to ant communication, most of this is happening via those pheromones, like you say. It's chemical messages detected by other ants through their antenna. And then this is supported by tactile, acoustic, and least of all, a little visual communication. So we're talking high-pitched chirps, strokes with the antenna and forelegs, vibration, and how's a helmet going to manage all of that?
Right, yeah. This is from the comics, too. I mean, they definitely build this into the Ant-Man character in the comics pretty early, because I think that was how their explanation basically for how he got around was that, like, he rode around on ants with wings.
Yeah.
And that's how he got from one place to another at tiny size.
The interesting part is that if you're looking at it as Ant-Man manipulating the ants and winning their aid, by making them believe that he's some sort of privileged ant, we actually see versions of this in the natural world. He's not the first organism to trick ants into doing his bidding.
Okay. I'm guessing this is stuff to blow your mind, so I'm guessing a parasite's going to come into play here.
You know it. You know it. Yeah. Type of specialized invertebrate parasite that are known, they're generally known and grouped together as myrmecophiles or ant lovers. And so what they've done is they trick the ant population into accepting or overlooking their intrusion. And there was a 2015 study published in PLOS-1 that examined a particular species of beetle, P. pavari. And this particular beetle makes its home inside an ant colony, and a heavily guarded, nearly impenetrable fortress that has all of these resources. It seems like the most dangerous place in the world as another insect to try and carve out your livelihood. It's like trying to live in Mordor, right? As a hobbit and just like stealing food here and there and just convincing everyone that you're supposed to be there.
Also an orc.
Yeah. So this particular beetle, it seems to achieve this through a complex dance of both chemical and auditory mimicry. So it convinces the ant that it's one of them, even as it feeds on their larva and benefits from the colony's protection.
Wow.
Yeah, and it seems like this beetle may even mimic the queen from time to time in order to receive royal treatment from the surrounding colony.
It's like back rubs and stuff.
Yeah, or just special protection, special feeding privileges. But it also knows the limits. Like otherwise it leaves the queen unharmed. It knows that's a line it can't cross.
Okay.
So it doesn't seek to decimate the host colony, but rather to thrive within it as a perfect parasitic member of society.
Right. If it started to disintegrate it from within, they'd probably catch on.
Yeah. Okay. So I could see Ant-Man working along those lines.
Okay. So there's a scene in Ant-Man, which is super exposition, where they're basically like training him how to use his powers. And Michael Douglas as Hank Pym does this thing where he's like, okay, these are like your allies. There's this kind of ant and this kind of ant. And this ant's really, really good for flying on. And this ant's going to build a bridge for you. And this ant stings really hard, right? Like they all have kind of their own superpower that he can apply in various situations. In fact, isn't there one that like absorbs electricity or something like that?
Yeah, the crazy ants.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and talk about the crazy ant a little bit here. The one that we're most familiar with here in the States is the crazy raspberry ant. And this one continues to make the news as it, invades Texas and Florida. It rolls over fire ant populations, actually. Like they end up wiping those guys out, which it might seem like that's good. Because crazy ants don't have that painful sting. You don't have to worry about your toddler wandering out and encountering them so much. But they do have a tendency to just overwhelm a home. They'll short out electrical boxes and crawl up into your computer and short that out too. And it's still kind of an open question as to why they seem to crave electricity. But some species of ants are capable of detecting electromagnetic fields and might even use the Earth's magnetic field as a navigational tool.
Yeah. And there's speculation that birds can do that as well.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So that's like, that's a whole nother like realm of a sensory realm that we as humans just don't have access to.
Right. So they would be a good ally to have down there at this smaller level of existence. But there's also a theory that crazy ants just mistake the fields associated with electrical gadgetry as road signs. but it's also possible that they're just scouting a new nest. And hey, you look at a computer, right?
Here's what's better.
Yeah, it's a dry interior. There are fewer entry points and exit points. It's just a great place, by their estimation, to secure a stronghold.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, I could see them making good allies. But again, with any of these ant examples, you also have to say, oh, how is Ant-Man convincing them to do all these operations so far away from their colony?
Yeah. You've seen it more recently than me. I'm trying to remember how he uses the ants. It's like when he's breaking into the super secure facility, he somehow...
Yeah, the crazy ants short out the...
Okay.
Yeah, the system.
Like the force field or whatever it is that's keeping him from getting out. Okay. Well, then there's the bridge building ants. And I have to say, I really liked the special effects for how they did the ants in particular.
Oh yeah, they look
great.
One of
my favorite parts of the movie. But the bridge building ants, that's for real. Fire ants can act like either a fluid or a solid. In fact, I think we did something on How Stuff Works Now about this recently in like the last month. It might have been Lauren Vogelbaum.
Yes, it was. I'll make sure to link to that on the landing
page. Yeah, because it's
episode.
Cool. There's some cool videos from the studies that these guys have been doing. In fact, they're right down the street over at Georgia Tech. Guys, Zhongyang Liu and David Hu have observed this fluid solid shifting back and forth between, now it's not one fire ant shifting back and forth between states. It's a whole colony of them, but they can basically pour themselves out like a liquid or spring back when something presses down on them. In fact, in the video, they show like, it's not like a brick, but it's something heavy and they're pushing down on like 50 ants, and the ants all kind of like spring back and forth to allow, for that pushing. So fire ants, the reason why they have this ability is they have to cope with periodic downpours in their natural environment. So they evolved the ability to clump together into structures. And so Liu and Hu are using rheometers, which are used to measure the flow of liquids or slurries like cement. To measure the viscosity and the elasticity of these balls of ants. And they found out that these fire ants can flow and move around as a group, acting like thick fluid, right? Or like rubber in some instances. And yes, they construct bridges to get across gaps in the same way that you see them do this in the movie. They can also quickly repair any damage to the structure they create, right? So like, let's say they make a bridge and like a rock falls and it kills like 10 of the ants. Well, the other ants are they're all going to sense this and reinforce the living structure and move in. The researchers actually subjected them to different vibrations to cause them to spring into action and fix the bridge at different frequencies. And they also pull closer to each other and tighten their grip to fill in holes, make sure that the structure holds together. The practical implications here apparently are that they're trying to figure out, well, how do these ants do this so we can replicate it and make self-assembling robots? So that would be fairly interesting if we had these little tiny ant-sized robots that could, you know, theoretically form bridges for us to drive across or something. I'm not quite sure how they would pull it off. It sounds like we're years away from something like that.
Yeah.
But it would be pretty cool.
Yeah. That, I mean, you'd basically have like a T-1000 kind of,
yeah, that's
situation.
What they compare it to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like the theory is, well, it's not a theory. They show this in the video, actually. If you drop a penny into a quote ocean of ants, you've just got this pile of ants, they absorb the impact of the penny dropping, that catching it and then slowly lowering it to the bottom of whatever they're in.
Huh.
And these live ants will even let go and behave like they're dead in some instances so that they can help decrease the viscosity of the overall ant structure and allow it to have more of a liquid flow to it.
Huh.
So that part of the science, bridge building ants, yeah, for real.
Cool. And that actually lines up rather nicely with the raft building ants that we also see.
Yeah.
This is, I think, the way that he infiltrates a high security lab is that he goes in through the water pipes and he's riding in a raft made up of ants joined together into a little structure.
Yeah.
And we actually see this with a number of different ants. They bind together into a raft when cataclysmic floods threaten the colony. And, you know, they do this pretty much in the same way that you've described the formation of these bridges.
Yeah.
But you get into the question like, well, how do you build that structure? I mean, how do you arrange it? And that gets really interesting.
Right. How do you decide who's the one, which ant has to be underwater and drown?
Yeah. I mean, imagine, say, any group of people, you know, the crew of a pirate ship and the ship's sinking and they're like, all right, mateys, bind together because we're going to form ourselves a new boat made out of your bodies. Then, you know, what do? Cast straws to see who's going to be at the bottom, who's going to get to be on top. Well, there's a cool study that looked into this, a 2014 study from Jessica Purcell at the University of Lausanne, and she took a closer look at the raft's physical and social structure. Specifically, she looked at the functional geometry of rafts in the ant Formica celiesi. These are ants that are abundant in the floodplains throughout the Alps and the Pyrenees. Unsurprisingly, the queen occupies the center of the raft. She's the most important. She's the package. She is the ant man of this this particular raft.
Okay, so this is a scenario where he's probably making them think he's the queen.
Yeah, I would imagine. He would have to convince them, hey, I'm the queen, I'm important, you got to get me through.
Okay.
So tangled worker ants then make up the outside of the raft. And this is, might come as a shock, but the larval ant brood makes up the lowest portions of the craft. So they put they essentially put the babies on the bottom, which you wouldn't expect,
interesting.
Right?
Interesting. Okay.
But Lucene, but Lucene found that since the brood, the larvae are the most buoyant members of the colony, they actually survive exceedingly well down there and ultimately work really well as afloat.
Okay,
and so their survival rate was on par with the rest of the crew. And when brood items were not available to build the lower portion of the raft, the worker ants formed the bottom of the raft as well. But they also proved rather resistant to drowning, but required extended recovery time upon landing.
Okay.
So it's interesting to imagine these ants and think of these ants as this last-ditch survival effort. You just bind together into this raft, this ark, then you're delivered to this new location, and then everybody just starts setting up anew.
Wow. Yeah, just the social communication and decision making amongst ants is so alien and just alien to how we think about things. I mean, when I see ants come into my home through the windowsill up onto the kitchen counter, I kind of think about this stuff then. It's like, how do they decide? Who's the one, like, my wife's really into the, like, non-chemical application of, like, she puts cinnamon across the windowsills because they really don't like cinnamon. Some of them, like, force their way through the cinnamon and get, like, cough. They cough. Yeah, ants cough. they get covered in this stuff, and you can see them kind of immobile, but the others are like, great, they've made a path for me. I can move on through. It's, how do these make these decisions?
Yeah, it's crazy. I feel like we, every year, there seems like dozens of new ant studies come out.
Oh, and
there are always just some really fascinating, really mind-blowing bits in there. Like the most recent one that we did a Now video on had to do with lazy ants. So these ants that are in the colony, and they seem to just be standing around doing nothing. Uh-huh. And the scientists were trying to figure out, well, why are they doing nothing? Is there something wrong here? Are they reserve troops? That seems to be a prime theory. So the one theory was that maybe they're relaying communications.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
But they're not. It turns out they're less in tune with what's going on in the colony than anybody else.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, they just completely tuned out.
Okay, so we've covered parasites. We've covered bridge building. We've covered the electricity. What was the stinger ant? That was the bullet ant, right? Like their bite is particularly bad, and that's true.
Yeah, because we went into that in the Ig Nobel episode.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, Joe covered that section.
Yep.
So if you're saying, hey, I want to know more about those bullet ants, go back to our Ig Nobel Prize episodes from, I believe, November and check those out.
And there's one thing about the ants too that I don't have in my notes here, but I read it extensively in almost every article about Ant-Man and the science of Ant-Man, which is that they get the gender of the ants wrong because Ant-Man himself is giving male names to female ants. Cause isn't his buddy ant is Anthony. And they're saying like Anthony would actually be a female ant because of its particular kind of anatomy.
Yeah, and I'll buy into that because what does he know about ants, right?
Yeah, he didn't really seem to have a whole lot of idea about what was going on there. You'd think he'd do some research.
Yeah.
Like we did.
Paul Rudd was great in that role, by the way. I really enjoyed
him. Yeah, it was perfect. I'm looking forward to seeing more of him in these, I think he's going to be in that Captain America movie next year.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That'll add some levity to that.
And Corey Stahl was really good as the villain.
Yeah, Corey Stahl from The Strain, right, which we also did a Science Of episode. Corey Stahl seems to be finding himself cast in a lot of movies where movies or television that are like kind of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Where he's kind of in the mix somehow. He's always like he was a straight up villain in this, but sort of like an anti-hero in his other protagonist roles.
Yeah, he's good at playing
he in House of Cards as
he
well?
Was. He played a flawed alcoholic character in that, and then he kind of plays the same thing in The Strain. So he's great at playing these characters with that are fairly cardboard, but also have a certain amount of nuance to them. So
yeah,
he made for a fun villain, and I liked his little zapper that he used on people.
He was particularly menacing.
Yeah,
yeah.
All right, so there you have it. Just a breakdown of some of the science in Ant-Man, the film, the comic book series, and also touching on some of these examples of miniaturization science fiction. Obviously, we didn't touch on absolutely everything from Ant-Man or miniaturization sci-fi, so we would love to hear from everybody out there. What's your favorite piece of miniaturization media? What are your thoughts on the science of Ant-Man?
Yeah, and let us know about this stuff on social media. When this episode comes out, we're going to share it all over the place. But we will also be responding to and listening to your comments there. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, all those. We are Blow the Mind.
And as always, check out StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That is where you will find all the podcast episodes, all those blog posts, some videos, and links out to the social media accounts.
And finally, if you want to just talk to us directly about Ant-Man or whatever we've covered on the podcast recently, don't forget to tune into those Periscope shows on Fridays at noon Eastern Standard Time. We'll be around for 20 or 30 minutes talking science, talking horror movies. Usually we end up talking about some kind of monster of the week type scenario.
And as always, you want to get in touch with us via email, just shoot us one at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.